Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
Hello and welcome to the Undermine Podcast. I'm Tom Marshall, your host of these proceedings. We are right in the middle of our season at episode 25, a season where we're exploring fish in the 90s. We're really loving going back, visiting some of these epic shows of the early 90s as we draw closer to our goal, the famous Fall 97 tour. And whether or not Fall 97 is the peak of fish is, of course, debatable. And we're not really claiming that, but is Fall 97 a peak, a very significant peak? Definitely. And here we are at the Great Went, right on the precipice of Fall 97. And to help me navigate this precipice, the delightful and freshly groomed president of Osiris, my co-host, RJB.
Thank you so much, Tom. Wow, that was quite an intro. All right, so today we're covering our second and last festival of this season. Of course, the Great Went. This was the chapter that closed the summer of 1997. Both of these shows, 8/16 and 8/17, have so many highlights. It'll be hard to fit everything into this episode, but we're going to give it a shot. It's a pretty monumental show, set of shows. And as we learned in the 6/22/94 show, we're not allowed to rank festival sets in overall fish. So we're going to have to just, you know, leave these aside or rank them differently. But I want to tell you, if you're enjoying what we're doing, please consider supporting our new Osiris Premium offering, which you can join for just a few bucks a month. You can get bonus episodes of Undermine and HF Pod, ad-free episodes. And a lot of people have asked, where are the archives of Under the Scales? They're within this premium offering, which again is just a few bucks a month. We're going to have discounts on Osiris merch, meet and greets, AMAs, all kinds of stuff. OsirisPod.com/premium. Or click on the link in the show notes. So, Tom, who is going to help us go through this epic two-day situation?
Okay. Our guest, RJ, I'm extremely proud to announce, is the renowned artist, Jim Pollock. Jim is responsible for amazing show prints and posters and also drawings that appear on shirts and hats and all kinds of merch. And if you know fish, you definitely know Jim's art. And it's on the cover of Junta, and it's really everywhere. It's safe to say that Jim Pollock is Phish's primary artist. Although Phish does a great job of utilizing a variety of artists for their famous show posters, Jim's are instantly recognizable and become quite valuable. And Jim likes the old printing press technology. He had a press with him at the Great Went, and the posters he made that weekend are among the most sought after ever by collectors. But rather than have me yammer on about it, I'll bring Jim in from the waiting room to tell you more himself.
Hello.
He appeared. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us again. And you've been a good friend of the podcasts we've done. In addition to being Phish's most famous poster artist, you're also a huge fan of Phish's live shows. And I got to say, ever since I started seeing shows in the 80s, it was likely I'd see you there too, but even more so now at MSG, you're a fixture. You're like, whenever I'm there, you're as close as you can get to the front on Mike's side. You're always on Mike's side, and you're deeply enjoying the sound spilling from the stage. You like it up close, don't you?
I do. Less smoking. Jenny is a bit allergic to smoke, and people are more focused, and there's less talking and stuff. I don't know. But you know, you end up where you end up. I try to get closer. Yeah. It's mostly talking and stuff and being engaged in the music. It's fun. But, you know, I've came back a little during Dick's this year. It was nice being in the middle of the floor, but everyone's there's not much talking at Dick's. People are very engaged.
I did notice that. I was up in the stands of Dick's, and it was razor sharp focus on the music. It really was.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yep. Yeah, much different than the 90s, I'd say.
Yeah, just like
a lot of chatter. Exactly. Yeah. And live music. Like, I'm loving it.
Jim, I got to ask you first. There's all kinds of details about your multicolor printing process and the linoleum block and all the handmade things. And we actually talked to you about this in season 1, episode 7 of Undermine about Junta. But first, can you just give the background to the listeners about how you found Phish or how they found you? What just the brief background there?
Brief background. I showed up at Goddard College the same year Paige showed up, and we kind of hung out. We hit it off pretty good. We had a lot of common. We liked a lot of the same music, really, frankly. And he had a great record collection. And then the other guys came to Springfest, which is like this live music thing that Goddard College put on. And they showed up, and Paige was playing with a bunch of bands. And they were very fantastic. And we were just like, geez, you should play with them. And within a month, he was like playing pretty regularly with, Trey, John, Mike, and then the other guitar player. I'm spacing his name right now.
Jeff,
absolutely.
Old Jeff,
They were playing, within the month. He was playing regularly with them and stuff. And then, I'd carry some equipment and stuff like that. My back came in handy, that type of thing.
Well, so that's, obviously that's 83, 84, 85. Right, right. So we're fast forwarding a good 10 years to the Great Went.
So I left Vermont. I was in Chicago. And I'd see them when they toured around the country, and they'd hit Chicago and try to see their shows when they were there. They invited me to the Clifford Ball, and I went up and sold some art and stuff like that. I had some offset stuff made and starting to get into the printmaking process. And then by the next time, which is the Great Went, they invited me. I had acquired a bookbinding press and started doing the linoleum stuff. And that's when I kind of introduced all of that format to people. And up until then, I had done a lot of merchandise, mostly T-shirts, I'd say, in quantity. But like there had been like art for different types of small, you know, gigs and stuff like that, but nothing major. I had done Rosemont Horizon and a handful of prints, but it kind of started off my linoleum print stuff at Great Web, definitely.
Well, yeah, and I do remember, actually, I have one of your clown prints from the Clifford Ball. You signed it for me.
Oh, right.
And I'm very proud of that. That's like my earliest fish merch, I think, ever that I own.
Right.
And I was smart and framed it. So it stayed intact. but so the Clifford Ball had proven to the world that fish can put on an amazing experience. And a large part of that experience was the art and the artists and performers and the creativity that pervaded the atmosphere. Wow. And you brought prints that you had already made to that fest.
Yeah.
And then how did your setup differ at Clifford Ball from what you did at the Went? Because at the Went, you had a press.
Right. I had a press. The Clifford Ball was more like I had some pre-made stuff that I got at an offset shop. I was working in a Kinko's Copies, and that's almost what I blame for my printmaking. It was like running Xerox machines and going to art school in the daytime and kind of putting two to two together, but then like went really old school, like printmaking. But yeah, I don't know where that was going. But like, yeah, it was like we were in this like little village they always created. I guess Clifford Ball was like the first attempt at it. And like, I felt like Great Went really had an amazing infrastructure. And like, you know, did they just built on all the things that they had learned from the previous festivals?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, that was like part of it. And like during the day, people wandering around buying stuff and even buying stuff while the show's going and stuff. And yeah, it was just kind of, I don't know, like a little city. What was it? The second largest city in Maine.
Yeah, briefly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And Trey said during the show at some point, yeah, second biggest city after Portland, but way cooler than Portland.
That's true.
Jim, the Great Went Robot and the Walking Fish are some of your most like famous works, and these are really rare, and a lot of fans have them and some really want them. But how did you end up with these, and how did they become collector's items? Like what was that like, you
it
know,
was,
creating
Mother
them?
Nature. It was a rainy weekend. At that time I was printing on water-based inks, which is not a good idea. And like basically not too many of the prints made it out. And so because of that, like they're very coveted, also they're first. And then like, yeah, they've become, and like all of this happened when, I don't know, like eBay comes along, creates secondary markets. It's a weird like trade winds of like very good luck for an artist like me.
Definitely. You know, just to bring people who aren't into the poster scene up to speed, the limited edition posters, of course, are pretty valuable. And all your posters are like, you know, you sign them and you number them. So they're all like, they're a number out of say 500 or something, but back then at the Went, you didn't know how many you were going to print. So what was the total number of prints created for the robot and
the
fish?
It was 125. I always talk through stuff and like run the numbers. Is it okay if I did this? And like I made 100, I think I made like 100 or 125 of the Great Went robots, of which, yeah, somebody early on in the message boards, I forget his name, Terry Weedock, I think. And like somebody had made the list of like a database of like all of the Great Wents.
Did he corner
There's
the market?
Just a handful of them, like, you know, it's like 11 and like 32 and like, you know, and it's like all under 100. And then I sold like, yeah, I was like, I'll go home and like I'll keep people's emails And then like, I'll be able, and like, I moved like, I don't know, like 20 of them like online. Like back in the old days when they sent me money orders to my CoStar office box and like sent them prints. Like that's really, really old school. It's like, well, it's a little just before the internet's like got all its bells and whistles.
For the truly nerdy fish poster collectors, you had said that this was not your first poster. You said you'd, well, I mean, I've seen you do some like scribbled fish poster bills, just like right. with pen and
ink. Like for up in like Burlington. Like
yeah.
Early stuff. Yeah. Because like I had moved to Chicago, but was still sending Dionysian like art because they were always like, oh yeah, just send us stuff you're working on.
But you mentioned the Rosemont Horizon as your actual first. Was that before the Went?
Yeah, that's 95. And like, that's not a linoleum. That's a silk screen.
Oh.
But, I was kind of learning, I don't know, some of the ins and outs of, Photoshop and Quark Express. I think I like laid it out on, and, basically, yeah, it was actually for the Chicago Reader and it, they still hadn't sold it out. And so they actually took out an ad on the back of the Chicago Reader, which was my print. And then they were like, oh, that looks really cool. Let's make a poster of it. And then that was easily done. Because like I said, I started to have connections with like a lot of printers working for Kinko's and stuff. Led me into that world.
Yeah. Well, fast forwarding, I mean, you don't only work for fish. You do posters for all kinds of people, and people can go to pollockprints.com and check out other stuff Jim's done. But Jim, would you say that every single festival for fish, you did a poster, a special poster? No,
I did one for Magnaball, or for the official poster, I think only Magnaball. For Super Bowl, I did some water wheel cutout car things.
Oh, right.
Oh, and then I did an official for Indio.
And then there was a massive one for Coventry.
And there was a massive one for Coventry. the last fish show.
The last fish show. Right.
Yeah, 11,000. I only signed them.
That's
they got
incredible.
Somebody at Dionysian or like, dry goods to number
those,
right?
But still, you signed 11,000 posters.
I did, but I mean, why wouldn't you?
Right, exactly.
I'm an artist, I guess. Like, it feeds a part of me. Sure, I'll sign it.
Well, I just want to ask you, Jim, how much has your process? It sounds like your process has changed a lot, but do you have like a really set in stone approach to how you do art and posters when people come to you now, or is it still like case by case, like in terms of creation and production and all that?
It is different because like sometimes like I want to do like a linoleum, but like there might not be enough time. And so like I, you know, there's definitely like time constraints and stuff like that are related to the process that I'm using. So like a silk screen might take shorter and like be able to like, do something. I almost have to anticipate like when am I going to do like a linoleum because it's going to take like a fair amount of time. So it has changed, but like, yeah, at first I was just doing linoleum, but now I've kind of like given myself the ability to work in other mediums and stuff like that.
Before we go off to break, I want to give the YouTube people on video a chance to see number 92.
There it is.
Of 100.
Holy. Yeah. Not too shabby shape, really.
perfect condition shape of the walking fish. It's probably one of my proudest fish's posters that I've been able to obtain.
Yeah. It was pretty rainy, but then it started to clear up and then like things were drying. But the first day, it was kind of touch and go with the drying.
That's amazing. Well, it's time to talk about the music, and we're going to do that right after we return from this quick break.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's distrokid with a capital K.com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's distrokid, capital K.com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
So, okay, let's talk about the music, Jim, and thank you for enlightening us on this, the art process. So there, we had six sets over 2 days. And I mean, there's so much to talk about here. It's hard to get it all into one conversation. But the first day, I felt like, well, both the whole weekend was just such a celebratory vibe. And, you know, this was really representative of where Phish was going in the fall of 1997. You hear in some of these early songs of the first day, the Wolfmans and a couple others, you hear this kind of like evolution on the 95-96 sound, but it's not quite where it gets in fall 97, but it's a little dark, it's a little funky, dangerous, but still like, you know, celebratory in a way. And I'm wondering, I know you guys were both there, just curious, like what the vibe was like there. I know it was hugely, you know, populated area, but was it a celebratory weekend? And do you guys have any memories of the first day in terms of the music?
Yeah, well, the first day, yeah, it was like, I'm looking at my notes, but like, I was noticing that I had not, it was like a first for a lot of songs for me, the ones that were debuted in Europe. Like, as I said, like, I only hit Chicago shows. So like, I don't know, there were some, no, Ghost, a lot of stuff that was the first time was in the second night. But like the first night, I don't know. Character Zero. That was my first Character Zero. And then Loving Cup, I'm like a huge fan of like Exile on Main Street. Paige and I used to play that album a lot. And then like, I think I had only heard it once, but it was like, you know, I was like, kind of like knocked out of my whole art selling and like, oh, I need to hear this. Get my head out of the little hut and like listen to the stuff. And that was basically, yeah, it was, I was hearing stuff, but then like sometimes I just had to, okay, I just have to get out of here and like listen to something, you know? Because yeah, we were in the thick of this little town and stuff like that. And there was, you know, it was easy to get distracted. But yeah, definitely, yeah, hearing new songs. And then like, you know, oh, wait a second, you know, can you be quiet? Because like, I'm a fan too.
Yeah.
Kind of. And like people, you know, totally got it. And like other people are hearing those songs for the first time as well. There was a lot of debuts for me. Yeah. And Ghost. Ghost was a debut. Or is that?
Yeah.
That's the first name.
That,
that's the first
that,
I've heard.
that summer. Yeah. I mean, that summer, and that was a great version. I mean, really, again, like very funky, but just like really a taste of what Ghost would become.
Right.
There's so much good stuff there. Tom, what was your experience at the Great Wind? We haven't asked you that yet. So, like, where were you, and what are your memories of this 2-day party?
This is kind of like back when in the 90s were a whole different experience than they are now for the band and for me and for backstage access and all that stuff. If I wanted to go on tour with the band, Trey just had to ask the band, hey, do you mind if Tom comes on the bus? And it could be like 3 to 5 nights, and I would just go from concert to concert. So the way that and now that would never happen. Like, well, first of all,
hardly, right?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's kind of no backstage now. But secondly, they all have individual buses, and like the whole thing it's a whole different scene. But this was incredible. I drove up with some friends and immediately found Trey. I think this is the day before actually the first show. And Trey took me and my friend Tebow and my friend Scott around on a golf cart. And it was sort of late. He was very excited. He was pumped. He was showing us the grounds and driving us all around, at like looking at the art installations. We probably saw Jim setting up for the first day. And we cruised by, and then Trey veered into the camping, and it's very much unlike him, and certainly unlike him today. He stopped the cart and ran to a random person's tent, unzipped it, and put his head in and said, "The show's canceled. Go home."
And then, always the kidder.
Yeah, always the kidder. And then ran back out and got behind the golf cart steering wheel, but wanted to see what the result of that yelling was. And those people had been asleep, and they were like stumbling out. And there, I heard the girl say, "Was that Trey?" Imagine, somewhere out there are those people that. Yeah, exactly. I want to find those people though. Like, I eventually found the person who caught my glasses I threw out from when I was did the Proclaimers.
You know?
10 years later, I found that guy. So we should be able to find the person who Trey put his head in at the Great Wind into their tent and woke up and said the show is canceled. But the music was amazing. The parties were amazing. I had an incredible, incredible time. And yes, positivity and festival atmosphere was in the air 100%. And the music was was just incredible, unbelievable. I mean, we haven't even mentioned the Went Gin yet.
Right. Well, that's
yeah. Like,
That's the next
step. Yeah, it's
and
a whole different
daytime day. Sets are always so fun with the festivals. It almost reminds me of when I first saw them, which was outdoor. And like back in Vermont, you'd see a lot of like daytime sets, people playing outside. And you don't see it as much like as they got more popular. It was always a nighttime. And so I always liked that. The sun beating down.
Yeah. And I was like, it was probably too early for me to make this rule, but if I saw Punch You in the Eye outdoors, I was a happy person. That meant the rest, and it still does for me. It means that the show is going to be great. And so this is set one of the Great Wind, Punch You in the Eye. And I remember I was the happiest guy. And then right after that, like you said, Ghost I don't know if that was the actual debut, but it was, it was still relatively new and a great song, and it came right after that. Yep.
Pretty amazing. And the cities, the set three, I mean, it's like this, you know, 6 songs. It's Haley's, Cities, Llama, Lawn Boy, Limb by Limb, Funky Bitch. And a really like really kind of jammed out limb by limb before the ending Funky Bitch where there are fireworks after. And that to me is like, you know, the five or six song second set is, or third set in this case.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing. I think my highlight of the whole show is probably the cities. Like it's so slow. And on the audience version, you can hear people saying like, I think they're going to play something fast after this. Cause it just feels like it's like, that's how that whole summer was just sort of like, it was slow, you know, but in a really, it carried everyone along, you know?
Was Llama, so you got your wish, right?
The llama, slowed it down. They really slowed it down for
the slow llama, exactly. What Jim, the second night, I mean, I think the second night is, you know, one of the most legendary shows ever, mostly because of this second set of Down with Aziz, Bathtub Gin. But that whole thing, set one has this amazing maze, which is really intense, and it has a tweezer that's great. But this Down with Aziz, Bathtub Gin, it almost feels like it's celebratory, but almost like emotionally wistful. Like it almost feels to me like they're like a little bit looking back on this year and like not wanting this amazing tour to end. But maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I feel like that Bathtub Gin, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how it is to be a musician. But yeah, it's like, if you slow it down, can you distill it more kind of thing? Yeah. Cause you don't want to rush through anything.
Yeah. It's so powerful. Do you remember that in person?
In Europe, and like, they just seem to be just like nonstop on the road. And then like, I mean, thus spoke this Zarathustra, also spoke in the 2001, what?
2001, we'll call it.
Yeah.
But like and then also, with like I hadn't seen that too many times. I might have seen it once, but not played as like large as it. And I remember pausing and like, yeah, I have to stop selling art and listen to this. And that whole day was like with the banger, Philharmonic.
Oh yeah.
Symphony, and like there was a lot of classical music stuff, and I feel like that was almost like a nod to that stuff that had already been played, and Debussy, and like, I don't know. It's just I've always considered Trey as like just another, you know, composer in that same regard. Just, you know, using the rock milieu, but like it's more or less a lot of the same, I don't know, tricks of the trade of a composer, basically.
That's awesome you say that. I mean, there were a couple little musical highlights, like you know, the first night, if you stayed up late enough, they kind of DJ'd a disco set.
Yeah. I didn't see that. Yeah. I saw the flatbed thing.
Oh, at Clifford Ball.
Oh, that's Clifford Ball. Yeah. No, I didn't see the disco. I was wiped out. Yeah, I mean,
you were working, so you were working and playing. Yeah, we were just playing, so we stayed up for the disco thing, and that was interesting. And as you know, every festival they've tried to do something kind of a little bit outside the lines, which is really cool. Yeah. But like you said, the Bangor, Maine Philharmonic Orchestra playing at least, you know, several classical numbers, but it was accompanied by a glider that was like spewing smoke as he was doing incredible stunts above the audience.
Yeah. Just amazing. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, I just, and then like, you know, how often do you see Philharmonic Orchestra playing in the middle of, I mean, you can go to places, but it's cool to hear them outside.
And it's funny you say that Trey is in your mind, like, you know, if he was 500 years earlier, he'd be like pals with like Bach or something.
He's our own Paganini here. Yeah. Bringing in the guitar for the
violin. Totally.
So that was between the first and second sets, the orchestra.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
And then it was during the day. Yep.
Yeah. Give, you know, more stuff. Cause like the break in between the nighttime and the daytime and stuff like that. Yeah, it was really, I mean, I don't know. It was like really cool to see that. You know, I'd be up for that again.
I love classical music.
I was late raised in a kind of classical music kind of family. So yeah, I love that stuff. Yeah.
When you get taught piano, you don't really have a choice. You learn classical. But I think when you get taught guitar and drums, you learn on rock.
Yeah.
It's definitely pretty interesting these days that's what it is. But still piano, it's like you learn, you know, Chopin, Beethoven,
Bach. And you learn to read music sometimes.
Yeah. But it's interesting how that is. And yet Trey did. He had that very, very developed classical sense. Right. And he still does.
Yeah. It's just amazing. I mean, to see the development of it and like, I don't know, at the other end, like we get like very large, we start off with fugues, which are generally short, but then he's broadened it to like, I don't know, like I think of a petrichor as almost like, I think of that as a ballet. I don't know. But like,
interesting.
A lot of movements, but like a lot of, rhythm changes, meter changes, and stuff like that. Yeah. When I saw him at Bangor, Maine, I was like kind of in the back of the crowd and stuff like that. And there were a bunch of couples all kind of like dancing to petrichor. And like they had like, it was almost like they had danced to it before. And like, yeah, I always think of, gosh, it's almost like a ballet. It's like it's a very danceable thing.
Did you see when petrichor was turned into the New Year's?
I did.
And there was some dancing in that, of course.
It worked well with David Gallo and his troupe. Absolutely.
That's right. So I was going to ask you again about the music and how pianists kind of start with classical. Your pal Paige, when you met him at school at Goddard, was he sort of classically trained, or was he already sort of coloring into the jazz world?
He was trying to learn to read music more. I think he like was there to basically kind of, he knew by ear, he knew, but like he couldn't sight read. I think he was like, basically he was on a mission. I mean, like he, unlike some Goddard students, but like, you know, he really, I mean, he was in the hay barn pounding out the piano. You'd hear him all the time. And just like, he was really good. I mean, he had great technique and stuff like that, but like, yeah, he, taught himself like, you know, the rudimentary things that he needed to do to become like a musician. And like, good on him. I don't know. I mean, like, I just think it was more spotty, that he was more of a jazz reading charts and chords and like, and being able to hear and play melodies and stuff like that. But like when you get into the more sophisticated, like, I don't know, harmonies and stuff like that, it's nice to see it all written out and know how to like know all the where the notes are and stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure. Lots of ink has been spent on, and of course, as Fish students ourselves, we know all about Trey's senior thesis at Goddard being the Gamehenge saga, so to speak, the rock opera. Did Paige have a senior project as well?
I forget. I think I had left by then. I had gone to Chicago, and like I had heard. And I think he was like, it was mostly like recordings, and he was doing some film stuff, so it was like mostly like type of performance projects. I really think he was like thinking about like making music for films. And he was like, we had some film equipment at school, and we were doing like film and video and stuff, and it's kind of cool.
It's appropriate because Fish.
I forget exactly what it was.
Fish
but
with
like,
these.
I think he like became really good at sight reading and like, you know, just, you know, teaching himself. And then they had Lois Harris, who was the music teacher there. And she worked with all of those guys, or with Trey and Paige and John. They were all under, and she was teaching them stuff. You know, theory and that stuff. They came in from the jazz thing. They could read charts, fake books, and that kind of thing.
Yep. That's interesting. Yeah, I never thought to ask Paige ever what his Goddard graduation project was, but maybe being part of Gamehenge might have sufficed, because he was, you know, he did all the
right.
He did all the keyboards for that. That's really interesting. RJ, my favorite, possibly favorite moment was the world cluing in on Buffalo Bill, set three opener. Buffalo Bill. I remember my friends like slapping me on the back, like, oh my God, they played it again. I think it had played once or something, and no one thought they'd ever see it again.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. That was the first time it had been played since New Year's 94. So been 204 shows. And it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit jammed out. It's a great version. And that third set, I mean, every set of this, and I don't think, if people listening or watching think that we haven't talked enough about a particular jam and the Great Went, you're right. Cause it's just impossible. the third set's great too. The Buffalo Bill, there's a great, Son of a Mule, like one of my least favorite Fish songs. There's a really good version. Great Caspian to close. It's just,
right. I mean, our first Caspian. Look at that.
So you were getting a lot of those songs that had been debuted over the, you know, year or two before.
Right.
For the first time.
Yeah. And like, that's, it's awesome. Always different when you know, hear it for the first time, or I don't know. Yeah. Like in that case, like, I don't think there was a recorded version before.
No, definitely not. I do want to say, just, you know, the Bathtub Gin has its own, the Went Gin has its own Facebook group, or multiple. Right. So we have to just, you know, mention that that's
the,
you know, I think there's a Facebook group called the Went Gin Changed My Life, which is, you know,
is that the
totally
2.0 jam?
I mean, it's, yeah, right. Type two. Yeah, it goes. I mean, it's so celebratory. It's so powerful. It's so like, I mean, it's positive, but it's also just very driving. Yeah. It's so moving. I mean, I can't get enough of it. Every time I listen to it, I'm like, I cannot believe that this happened.
Yeah, I mean, that song is like, I mean, yeah, I always wanted, you know, early on, I was like, God, did you really write this? Because, like, I could swear I heard that before. Like, you know, like, it's almost like a Austin Powers 1960s kind of.
Or a Broadway theme or something.
It's just like, wow. It's because it's like an ear. Yeah, it's an ear. Good. It's like, wow, how did you think that up? Because it seems to be everywhere. And yeah, it's but like
so
it,
amazing.
I extended it so much, and like, yeah, it just gets better and better with like the expansion of it, and every time they approach it in a, I don't know, a newer way. Yeah.
Yep.
It's really amazing. Tom, I guess before we wrap up, this is the last show that we're going to talk about before we get into Fall 97, which is the tour that changed everything, as we've been saying. What do you guys both think about like this ending this? I mentioned at the beginning, I feel like they were not wanting to get off the road. Maybe they're always feeling that, like this festival just feels so celebratory. Like, it doesn't feel like they have any, you know, there's no like, we're a little tired or anything. It's just full energy for 2 days. And this, you know, they have a little bit of a break before they come back for this fall tour. But I don't know, how do you guys feel like they ended up after this 2 day festival? Like, do you guys remember how it felt after the festival? Was everyone just left like wanting more? I mean, I'm just curious how that felt, because I wasn't there.
I do remember.
they were done, like the Phish production staff. It was funny, like doing that stuff. Yeah.
I remember some festivals, and I don't have to name names necessarily. I'm sure people know what I mean. When the band got off, they were done, like dead. Right. But this one was like, this is still 97, and everyone was smiling, and everyone was full of energy and ready for the next thing. And yeah, I mean, this was a huge effort, and everyone was tired. Yeah. But it was like tired with an amazing smile, and knowing, you know, walking off knowing that you had crushed it, right? Completely crushed it.
Totally. Yeah. But it takes so much effort.
So much out of everyone.
Especially hanging out with people that were putting the whole thing on.
Yeah.
And they were like,
they're on 4 days of no sleep, five maybe.
4 days of no sleep.
Yeah.
I drove the truck back to Burlington from, I mean, like,
we're lucky to have you still here.
Yeah. Anyone want to drive? Who's still awake? I'm like, I got this.
Wow.
Route 2. I'm like, that's quite the road.
I mean, yeah, and it's way the hell up there. Jim, did this, I assume that putting on a festival is an insane experience. Like you said, everyone was dead and everyone was exhausted. Does it get easier as people go along, or is it always just like a full on, effort?
So much easier. I mean, it's just best practices. They get better at doing it, and they have better people who have done it before. I mean, that was like the second or third one. It was like, it's early on. They're like still getting the number of porta potties right. And that type of thing. We're like, you know, it's, I don't know, that's difficult. Like anyone trying to put on stuff like that, it's more power to them. Because I think in the early ones, people just taking on as much as they can to have the thing happen and have it happen. But yeah, I mean, I think it's gotten much, much easier, or like, I don't know, not easy, but like, I don't know, just they've done it before so many times that they know how to do everything. And back then it was like, it was kind of new, and like, you know, little crossed fingers, which insurance companies hate.
Can we expect Jim to have you at the next Phish Festival with a printing press?
Oh, I could do that. Yeah. I don't know. I'll have to ask my shoulder, my arm.
RJ and I request it specifically from you. We would consider it a favor if you do that.
Right. Yeah. I was told they still had that hut somewhere. I'm sure it's long gone.
That's amazing.
Like, the hut that they put me in. Like, disassembled it. And they were like, okay, for the next one, we have the hut, the Pollock hut, where you're printing.
I believe that. There was a warehouse.
Oh, is there?
There was a warehouse that had some stuff. Yeah.
They threw away the
Magnaball
sign, so I doubt.
They've done some clearing of stuff.
I think
We're always like, yeah, we got your hut for you. You know, next time we have a festival. But I kind of missed some. I missed it. Lemon Wheel, Oswego, Big Cypress, and then I went to Super Bowl. And then went to Magna Ball. I think Super Bowl, I only went a couple days.
I love all the festivals and look forward to seeing the great Jim Pollock at the next one. And he's going to have his printing press with him. He just promised us. And RJ, thank you so much. Thank you, Jim Pollock. Reminder to go to Pollock. Absolutely.
It was nice. It was really fun.
Go to pollockprints.com. That's P-O-L-L-O-C-K prints.com to see more of Jim's stunning signature art. Thank you to all listeners and thanks to the Osiris team. And I want to give a quick shout out to Cash or Trade, the world's only social network where fans buy, sell, and trade tickets at face value. Check them out at cashortrade.org. Remember to review and subscribe wherever you listen or watch. Goodbye. And always please continue to blaze on.
Osiris.
Hey, music fans. We wanted to let you know about Music on the Mountain, a show that will feature Anders Osborne, Dogs in a Pile, and Saints and Liars. This show will be directly after the Divided Sky Foundation's fun run at 2 p.m. on Saturday, May 18th at the base of Akemo Mountain in Ludlow, Vermont. The show is presented by The Phoenix, a national nonprofit organization offering support to those in recovery and anyone impacted by substance use to celebrate recovery. If you're running in the Divided Sky Foundation's fund run, you'll be automatically registered for the show. It's a family-friendly event, and all proceeds from ticket sales and other donations benefit the Divided Sky Foundation. Visit Music on the Mountain, that's musiconthemtn.com, for more info and to get tickets. That's musiconthemtn.com. Hope you enjoy.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freights from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11. Oh.